Hello, everybody. Today we're going to take a look at a teaching that we did at Revolution Church on August 4th, where we looked at the movie Green Book as part of our summer drive-in teaching series. For whatever reason, the recording didn't quite make it, so we're going to try to recreate this the best we can. Now, obviously, we can't watch the video clips, so the best that we can do is try to refer you to those specific video clips. Or hope that maybe you can take it upon yourself to watch the movie when you get a chance to watch it. Now the name, the title, the Green Book, is derived from a publication that was issued back for a period over 30 years, really. And it was really a directory to kind of help people to steer them towards safe places that they could travel for non-white travelers traveling across North America, specifically in the Deep South, where segregation was still very real. Jim Crow laws were still in effect. This was prior to the Civil Rights era. Now, this book released a new edition each year for 30 years. It was written by a man named Victor Hugo Green, hence the name Green Book. I would encourage you in your spare time to go out and just do a search for Green Book. You could probably find examples of the publication out on the internet. During the teaching, we did have some physical examples that you could look at thanks to the hoods. So check it out if you can. The movie itself is based on the story of two men, Tony Lip Vallelonga, who was an Italian-American, and Doc Don Shirley, who was an African-American. Don Shirley was a classical and jazz pianist, and Tony Lip, his nickname was Lip, was a bouncer at the Copacabana. Now, I know all you Barry Manilow fans remember the Copacabana, right? Tony was a bouncer there, and the Copacabana was going through some renovations, and they were going to be shut down for a period of about 4 months. So Tony was temporarily out of work, and he was looking for a job. He also struggled a little bit with financial issues. He had a lot of family living in the house, and we caught a glimpse a little bit at Tony's narrow-mindedness, his prejudice, if you will. He was a little bit bigoted towards certain people. We saw a couple of African Americans in his home working on the floor that they had hired to come in as contractors, and Tony's wife offered them something to drink, so they drank out of a couple of glasses, and we see in a later scene where Tony actually threw these glasses in the trash. So this was just the writer's way of just helping us to see what was going on inside the heart of Tony Vallelonga at this time. Doc Shirley was a highly educated black man and a musical virtuoso who lived alone above Carnegie Hall. He was very wealthy, and he lived alone with servants. Doc was planning this tour of the Deep South, and he had heard that Tony was someone who might be able to provide him with some protection that he might need, and also be his driver. So that's what we see in the first scene that we showed on August 4th, with this interview between Doc and Tony, and we also saw the contractor scene, to kind of give you an idea of the kind of person that Tony was, as well as Doc in the beginning of the movie. Now, the rest of the movie chronicles the next 8 weeks of the tour, which actually included Louisville, leading up to Christmas Eve of 1962 in Birmingham, Alabama. It is a pre-civil rights movie filled with racial tensions and drama, as well as many funny moments, and transformation that we saw through the eyes of both men as they learn about each other. Now, this movie has been criticized by many for being just another white savior film. But I've watched the movie four times, and I see it as so much more than that. I see it as a movie that illustrates how the heart can evolve when given the chance to see the humanity in others. These two men went on to have a friendship that lasted throughout both their lives. But they were two people cut from completely different molds, different backgrounds, different skin color, different classes. The list goes on and on. And I loved and really enjoyed watching Tony's attitude shift gradually as he experiences the prejudices of the Deep South with his new friend and employer, Don Shirley. And by the end of the movie, we see an entirely different Tony emerge from the experience. And he and his family are better off for the change. And Doc Shirley has changed as well. As he learns from Tony things like basic street smarts and southern culinary options. And, of course, Doc was always trying to help Tony to be a better person, teaching him how to speak properly, teaching him how to avoid profanity, teaching him how to make better moral decisions. Each of these men, they grew from the experience because of being together and learning from one another. So the next scene that we showed on August 4th really highlighted this relationship. The first scene was the letter scene. When Tony left, his wife asked him or made him promise to write her letters while he was gone. Of course, he's going to be off for 8 weeks. Of course, Tony wasn't very articulate, and he struggled with the letter writing, and Doc caught on to this while he was watching him write. So he basically had Tony dictate word for word what Doc told him he should be saying to his wife. So that was a funny moment. And of course, they had another moment in the car where Tony stopped and got some Kentucky Fried Chicken, and he got a bucket of it. And Doc claims that he had never had fried chicken before. So the exchange between the two was pretty funny. So we see these two men rubbing off on one another, learning from one another, growing together from the experience. Now, I talked a little bit about racism. I first learned about racism, like many of you probably did, at an early age. I was in my mother's bedroom, and I came across a box of pantyhose, and there was two African-American people on the box, and I asked her who they were because they looked different to me. I'd never seen them before, and she told me to go talk to my dad, and of course, he was in the living room hanging out with some relatives, and that was the first time that I had heard the N-word. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be the last. In 79, we ended up moving to Kentucky, and racism just seemed to be much more prevalent in this part of the world than it was where I came from in Ohio. And one of the first kids to make friends with me was a kid named Anthony Scott. Anthony Scott was an African-American kid. We were in sixth grade, and we hit it off. We got along great. You know, we both loved athletics, and we kind of stood out on the playground. Our friendship developed pretty quick. As a new kid, you know, having somebody make friends with you is kind of a big deal, right? So as we did in those days, I wanted to invite him to spend the night. So I asked Mom if Anthony could spend the night. And of course, I was told no. And I guess it was then and there that I realized that there was this divide. And it was confusing to me because I didn't really understand why. And we lived out in the middle of nowhere, which meant I didn't really have a lot of neighbor kids to hang out with. I didn't live in the suburbs. So I learned how to entertain myself with comic books. And I know there's a lot of you that shared in that childhood experience with comic books. Now, mine was Marvel Comics, and I loved the X-Men. And believe it or not, it was in the pages of those books that I first learned about the evils of racism. And I learned that through the attitudes of people like the great Stan Lee, who was the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, who often wrote against prejudice and racism. And I learned about it through the story arcs, the character arcs of the superheroes in the X-Men comics. So, even at a young age, I guess I began to realize that this kind of attitude just wasn't right. Now, fast forward a few years, I ended up joining in the Air Force right out of high school. And I enter into this melting pot of culture that our U.S. military exposes us to. And I also began to see a different kind of racism when I got stationed in the Northwest up in South Dakota in Rapid City. As I experienced the hatred between the Native American population in South Dakota and the white folk, particularly the military. Because I watched as the Sioux Nation were treated like second-class citizens, and it was heartbreaking to see how their culture was shunned and looked down upon by others. The impoverishment was just overwhelming, and I'd never seen anything like that before. And then when I moved to Abilene, Texas, I began to see a different kind of racism between the white and the Latino population. And as I grew older, I became more involved in the church. I thought for sure that the hearts of God's people would be an escape from the hatred that I had seen growing up in my travels. Of course, as you can well imagine, I was wrong. I remember being told once by somebody that I looked up to, a spiritual mentor to me and a close friend of mine. I remember hearing him say how he thought that interracial marriage was not biblical because of some obscure Old Testament passage that he couldn't even cite or quote. And I was particularly taken back by this because not just because I looked up to this guy, but I had just entered into an interracial marriage. Because I don't know if you realize this or not, but my wife, my beautiful wife, Trish, does not lose her tan in the wintertime, right? And I remember as recently as 2007, being told by one of the elders and one of the congregations that I was serving in at that time. Now, this was a different denomination. But I was on the pulpit committee, and we were doing a search, and we had an African-American apply, and he came, and he delivered a sermon. And I remember hearing this particular elder make the statement that they didn't want African-Americans to start coming to this little country church for fear that their kids would mingle and start dating. And I guess it just blew me away that this kind of hatred still existed. My heart broke. See, I don't really remember learning how to hate in Sunday school. And when I turn on my TV and I hear the things that I hear and I read the things that I read on social media, I'm convinced now more than ever that the church needs to open up its eyes to the injustices and oppressive attitudes that we not only just live around, but in some cases we might even take part in or be complicit in. Paul explains it like this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, or as some might call it, 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongues of men or angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. And it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Beautiful, right? We've heard it before. One of the top 10 most familiar passages probably in all of Scripture. I'd be willing to bet that 9 out of 10 weddings will refer to this passage, and why not? It's perfect. Love is patient. Love is kind. The greatest of these is love. That's poetry, right? No wonder it's so popular. But what most people don't realize, although very relevant and applicable to weddings, Paul wasn't really talking about a romantic kind of love. And his motives for writing this passage had very little to do with the love that might be experienced between two lovers. It all goes back to this thing that we call hermeneutics. Now, the great Webster defines for us hermeneutics as the art of finding the meaning of another's words and phrases and of explaining it to others. And when it comes to biblical hermeneutics, there are so many factors that one has to consider: the context, the audience, the culture, the language, the time, the literary genre, and so on and so on. Paul's audience was the church in ancient Corinth, which was quite troubled, by the way. See, these people just couldn't figure out how to get their act together. for us to understand this, we got to learn a little bit about the city of Corinth to begin with. See, the city of Corinth was this cosmopolitan city. It's set on a small sliver of land between two bodies of water, and people from all over the Mediterranean would converge to Corinth. Goods were brought into the city by ship. It was a harbor town. Sometimes even the ships, because the sliver of land was so small and the distance around the rest of the continent was so vast, it was simpler for them to pull the boats across the land to get to the other side where they could sail on. So Corinth was a melting pot of culture and ethnicity, as well as religious beliefs. Even in the morally corrupt society of the Roman Empire, it was Corinth that stood out for being excessively moral. It was the Las Vegas of Rome. It was Sin City. Of course, we could do a whole series of sermons on things that we could learn from the issues of the Corinthian church, but the primary focus of today's lesson is that the church at Corinth was just overwhelmed with division. These factions were a reflection of the different beliefs and backgrounds the people had before becoming Christians. This is the context that this text was written from. You see, these folks were creating classes amongst themselves. Some perceived themselves to be greater than others because they were gifted in different areas. We see even more evidence of this classism later when Paul has to smack their hands for not seeing that the Lord's Supper is a place of commonality, or a place of solidarity, or even reverence, but instead as another reason to practice exclusion. Now, I wish I could tell you that Paul's letter to the Corinthian church echoed throughout millennia, and that these acts of exclusion were dissolved completely, never again to raise their ugly head, but unfortunately, we all know how history plays out, don't we? But what Paul is trying to instruct the church, the Corinthian church, and us, is that it doesn't matter who you are. If you don't have love, then you're nothing. Now, by the way, the original Greek word used here that was later translated into what we come to know as love is the word agape. Now, agape was the greatest of all loves. Okay, it came straight from God. It was self-sacrificial. It was gratuitous. It was the trump card of all of the loves that we knew of in the Greek language. Now, there were four different words that the Greek language used to describe the different kinds of love. And in the English language, it took all these words and threw them into a bucket and turned them into one word. This is why the word love loses so much meaning in our language, because in our language, when we use the word love, we can love everything from our grandkids to Sour Patch Kids, all right? We use the same word, but it has completely different power and meaning. Now, the word eros, which was also a Greek term for love, was a more intimate kind of love, a romantic kind of love. This is the root word of what we derive the word erotic from. And this word is not mentioned anywhere in the 13th chapter of Paul's letter to the church in Corinth. Now, this, of course, does not mean that this beautiful passage shouldn't be used as a reference for those who are celebrating the kind of love that we gather to witness when two people get joined in marriage. It certainly applies, okay? The text is fulfilled in the context that it's used in at weddings, so don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to be critical of those who use this passage in weddings. But the main point that Paul is driving home here is relevant to this discussion, and I don't want us to miss out on it. And that main point is simple. If you are a Christ follower and you do not have love, then you're just making noise. You're nothing. This is important because there are those who would try to use poor biblical hermeneutics to support another kind of Christianity, one that is harmful, one that is exclusive, and one that is oppressive. Our church history, the halls of our church history, echoes this kind of oppressive attitude. And you don't need me to tell you that racism and bigotry is still an unfortunate reality that we live in here in 2019. And I tell you, there's times when I wonder if things will ever get better. Now, the evening of August 3rd is the night before I gave this teaching, there was a shooting in El Paso, and I was following this on the news. And when I woke up on Sunday morning, I remember going out on the internet to look and see what the updates were on the shooting in El Paso, which, by the way, we find out later was racially motivated, just to find out that there was another shooting up in Dayton, Ohio. Now, they don't think that that one is racially motivated, but my point is, we talked about these things on August 4th on the heels of these tragic events where over 30 people were shot and killed in acts of senseless violence. And it was on the heels of these shootings that we joined together and we prayed and we asked God just to help us to find our place in this mess, to teach us how to be the church, to teach us how to be the light, to teach us how to be a city on the hill, to teach us how to be the change. And I have a hope that things will change, because I know that in the end, love wins. But one thing I know is we have to recognize as a church our influence on either the problem or the solution. Now, unfortunately, we have a history that we can't ignore, and we need to own this. We need to understand it so that we don't repeat it, but we also need to get educated. And I'm not talking about just academically. I'm talking about being willing to talk to people as human beings so that we can hear and experience their story. Now, on August 4th, I showed a few scenes from the movie where Tony was exposed to the prejudices of the Deep South, and he saw his newfound friend be a victim of these acts of hatred. And you see him make a transformation. You can actually see it in his face, as we showed about four, maybe even five different scenes of all of these different acts of hatred towards his new friend. You see, everything changes when you put a face to the issue. It's really easy to form an opinion in this world. All you got to do is open up social media. There's a lot of people out there that would love to share their opinion with you. And the sad truth is, most of us are influenced by our environment. We are influenced by our heritage, our families, even social media. And the sad truth is, most of us form opinions without hearing the real stories. And by real, I mean sitting down with people and treating them like human beings and listening to them. Now, naturally, I have opinions on the social issues of today, but my opinion isn't the topic. It's not my intention to try to influence your opinion. This is not a political sermon. It's not meant to be. I am just simply asking you to listen to the stories before you form your opinions, because you can't possibly hope to form an informed opinion without hearing the real stories. I can say with complete confidence that my opinion towards our nation's racial problems has evolved over time through my interactions with other people, people that I've worked with, people that I've attended church with, people that I've gone to seminary with. And as I've heard their stories, particularly with the African Americans, my eyes have been opened as I've listened to their stories and their stories of injustice. And my eyes are open to, yes, even my own privilege and how I was fortunate enough to be born on third base while there are so many who struggle just to exist. Hear me when I say this. This is about something so much more than blue and red or right and left. This isn't political at all. This has nothing to do with right and left. This is right and wrong. And the sad truth is, there is still so much happen, so much that still happens here in this country that loves to wave this Christian banner. There is still so much happening here that is simply just wrong. When in doubt, we just simply need to return to the words of Jesus. What better illustration of how we are to treat our brothers and sisters who might be different from us than the story of the Good Samaritan? If you recall, Rachel reminded us of this parable a couple of weeks ago. See, it was a Samaritan that went out of his way to help the Jew that had been beaten. Okay, this was significant because the Jews despised the Samaritans. But Jesus wanted everybody to understand and be clear that when he asked the question, who was the neighbor in the parable? It was the Samaritan. Because you see, to be a follower of Jesus, this was his message. We are called to be a neighbor to all. Everybody, no exception. That comes right out of Luke's Gospel, chapter 10. I also love the imagery that Jesus uses to describe the church in Matthew's Gospel when he calls us a city on the hill in Matthew 5:14. He says, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." To be a city on a hill, we have to speak love to our community. A city requires more than one light. It's interesting how Jesus wants us to be aware that he's showing us that we matter in a bigger story than just our own. We have to shine together. We have to work together. We have to speak love together. In order to be a city lit up for the benefit of those in the dark, we have to be willing to work together. This is why we use the candle imagery on Christmas Eve to remind us of how the great light of the world can shine through us. And by the way, what is darkness except for simply the absence of light? And every time that we are the light, we are punching holes in the darkness. And I believe in the power of the Holy Spirit to convict our hearts and to guide us towards how we can be punching holes in the darkness, how we can be the light. So when we approach those who are hurting, those who are being ridiculed, those who are being exiled, those who are being oppressed, those who are being ostracized or outcast in any way, we have to ask ourselves, are we punching holes in the darkness or are we punching holes in the gospel? Paul says, without love, we are a clanging cymbal. Listen to what this sounds like. So for each time we look down on our brothers and sisters for being different than us, each time we turn a blind eye to those who are being oppressed or culturally abused, or each time we think of ourselves as better than anyone because of where we come from, who we are, or how much money we make, what our skin color is, and yes, even our gender. Paul says, without love, we are nothing. What the Green Book shows us is that there can be a world where love can build a bridge over the ugliness that wants to separate us. We see a glimpse of this in the final scene. As they drive all night to get home for Christmas Eve, it is Doc who drops off Tony, and Tony goes up to his Christmas Eve party with his family while Doc appears to go home to be alone by himself in his very fancy and wealthy apartment above Carnegie Hall. And we see in this scene how Tony even gets defensive when members of his family call Doc names, and his wife is shocked at this transformation that she recognizes in this man that she loves, and she's impressed by it. And a few minutes later, we actually see Doc come to the door, and he knocks on the door, and Tony welcomes him into his home, and they embrace, and he introduces him to the family. And everybody there that night is touched by this moment. And it's just an amazing scene. It's my favorite scene in the movie. And of course, then the credits roll and we see pictures of the real Tony and Doc because it was based on a true story. I hope you do get a chance to take time to watch this movie. On August 28th, 1963, the great Martin Luther King Jr. stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and he delivered one of the most memorable speeches ever given in human history. His I Have a Dream speech became a defining moment in the civil rights movement, and it sparked a tidal wave of progressive change that has gradually moved through the next few decades, leading us to this moment. Now, we still have so far to go. I'm no Martin Luther King, but I also have a dream. I have a dream that one day the church of the kingdom of God will step up and illuminate with an intensity so bright that the power of love will truly triumph over hate. So bright that it breaks down the dividing walls that separate us and segregate us, the walls of racism, the walls of classism, the walls of these false perceptions of normality, or what we consider to be normal, or the walls of denominationalism, yes, even the walls of religion. I have a dream that one day the diversity in the Church of the Kingdom of God may be celebrated, and that Sunday will no longer be the most segregated day of the week. I do hope you'll join me. I want to thank you for listening. Have a blessed week. Now go and be the revolution.